content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. The phone number again, 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 14, 2025. As usual, the cover, the front cover, is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. The end game is captioned in large white print, and Time is in large block capital lettering in white, superimposed upon a background that's multicolored, multi-layered, actually, a lot of gold and brown and green. The cover photograph is of Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky in his presidential office, March 21. He is looking directly at the camera, dark hair, well-groomed facial hair, dark eyes, wearing black clothing. The first article is from The Brief Health, How to Relax and Unwind Without Drinking Alcohol, by Angela Haupt. Alcohol has long been synonymous with relaxation. Historically, if you wanted to unwind after a rough day at work, or kick back on the couch, or at a baseball game, or in the pool, there's a good chance you would have a drink in hand. Now the tides are turning. In early January, then U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a report warning that even small amounts of alcohol can cause cancer. Drinking just one alcoholic beverage a day increases the risk of liver cirrhosis, esophageal cancer, oral cancer, various injuries, a federal analysis suggests. According to a recent survey, nearly half of Americans are trying to cut back on their alcohol consumption in 2025, a 44% increase since 2023. As the science around alcohol's health risks crystallizes, a new question is brewing. What are you supposed to do to relax and unwind and escape your mental headspace if you ditch booze? Is there a healthier way to turn off your brain temporarily or shift into a happier place? If so, how do you achieve it? It's a real challenge because many of the alternatives are also addictive, says Dr. Anna Lemke, chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic and author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Grabbing a glass of wine is also so much easier than, say, hiking a trail or going to yoga class. But once people find a healthy alternative, there is an enormous sense of freedom that they no longer have to rely on this substance in order to function and feel, or not feel, as the case may be, she says. Figuring out how to kick back without booze is individual. Not every idea will work for every person, experts stress. Here is how they suggest starting your search for a relaxing alternative to alcohol. Five are listed. One, revive an interest. Many people have luck rediscovering long-forgotten hobbies like running, cooking, or crafting, says Laura Ray, a psychologist who runs the UCLA Addictions Laboratory. Plus, research suggests people who regularly engage in hobbies have fewer depression symptoms and better health, happiness, and life satisfaction than those who do not. We want folks to draw upon their life experiences and see, what do they find rewarding, Ray says. 2, seek out temporary, safe pain. Small doses of painful stimuli like weightlifting or ice baths can be beneficial. Activities like these are difficult, painful, or challenging in the moment, but make us feel better afterward, Lemke says. When you subject yourself to a healthy form of pain called hormesis, your body senses injury and in response increases production of neurotransmitters like dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. We make all of these feel-good chemicals within our own brain, she says. We do not actually need to go to look for them. 3, find a mind-body practice. Mind-body activities like prayer, meditation, tai chi, guided imagery, progressive muscle relaxation, and breath work help you connect with your physical sensations, emotions, and thoughts, Lemke says. Instead of using alcohol to distract yourself from your inner world, you will learn to tolerate uncomfortable moments. Research suggests mindfulness can spark positive brain changes, resulting in lowered stress, anxiety, depression, and other negative emotions. 4, treat yourself. Keep track of the money you'd have spent buying alcohol and buy yourself something nice instead, suggests Haley Treloar Padovano, Associate Professor of Behavioral and Social Sciences at the Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies at Brown University. Put what you save into a relaxation fund. Use it to splurge on a spa day, massage, weighted blanket, you name it. 5, get out there. Leaning into your friendships is one of the best ways to relax without alcohol. So hang out with people who will not pressure you to drink. Meaningful human connections release dopamine and opioids in our brain. Lemke says you might find you enjoy outings like walking in the park or going to the movies just as much as happy hour. This is a review by Stephanie Zakarik, a 1993 queer classic, gets a breezy update. Bringing children into the world and raising them is generally considered one of life's great joys. But for some hopeful parents to be, just letting things happen is not an option. Gay couples may choose to adopt or figure out some kind of family arrangement outside the long-standing one mommy, one daddy equation. And same-sex couples often face fertility challenges, just as hetero couples do. Add the expectations of would-be grandparents into the mix, and it's a wonder any child ever gets born at all. The Wedding Banquet. Andrew Ahn's updated rendering of Ang Lee's 1993 comedy drama of the same name uses those complex dreams and dashed hopes as a starting point to talk about everything that unites rather than divides us in modern America, a place where being gay is wholly accepted unless it is not, and all sorts of families are cherished unless they are not. Toss in cultural differences, and disaster is sure to ensue. But in its joyous way, this new wedding banquet reassures us that nothing worthwhile is ever easy. It is a fun, open-hearted picture, and even if it lacks the wistful subtlety of the original, it ends up on the same landing note. The people we love best are always worth fighting for. Bowen Yang and Han Ji-chan play Chris and Min, a seemingly solid Seattle couple, until Min's very rich grandmother, Yun Yu-jung of Minori, who's been bankrolling his stay in the U.S., threatens to bring him back to Korea, to run the family business. Meanwhile, Min and Chris's closest friends, Kelly Marie Trans Angela, a research scientist, and Lily Gladstone's Lee, an indigenous community organizer, have been struggling to conceive a child. Lee has just found out her second round of IVF has been unsuccessful. Together, the four hatch a plan. Angela will marry Min so he can legally stay in the country, and in return, Min will finance Lee's costly IVF treatments. Though the scheme ought to work, it is scrambled when Jae-yung touches down in Seattle for a surprise visit. Eager to stage a traditional Korean wedding for her grandson and his bride, she has no idea Min is gay, and hiding the truth from her is essential, or at least Min believes so. Ahn, that's A-H-N, director of the 2022 romantic comedy Fire Island, and James Shamus, who also co-wrote the first movie, have retooled the original story into a breezier, more freewheeling affair. As in the earlier film, the wedding ceremony is the high point. Min, the regal bridegroom, in traditional Korean garb, enters the banquet hall with a solemnity that makes him seem like a true grown-up, rather than the semi-goofy young artist he is. Angela, having ditched her hoodie-centric wardrobe to transform into a beaming bride, also strives to honor the seriousness of the occasion, though a secret she's been carrying makes a royal mess of the proceedings and opens stress cracks in the relationships of both couples. Mostly, this new wedding banquet is brisk and funny. When Min learns his grandmother's on the way, Angela, Lee, and Chris have just 45 minutes to dequeer Angela and Lee's comfy ramshackle house, whisking a copy of Elliot Page's memoir off the coffee table, and debating whether an elderly Korean lady will have any idea what a Lilith Fair poster represents. To be on the safe side, they hide that away too. The tone of this wedding banquet is very different from Lee's original, which ended on a bittersweet, if tender, note, as it reckoned with the ways children cannot always fulfill the dreams of their parents. But Ahn's version has its own strengths, including a quietly sublime ending that reminds us of a truth that ought to be accepted as a given. There is no such thing as a conventional family, beyond the love and commitment that hold any family together. In 1993, Lee's wedding banquet rang true to the experience of many young people who found it hard to come out to their parents. In 2025, the battle for gay rights is fraught in new ways. We could all use a laugh, and what is a wedding but a time for celebration and a wish for the future? Turning the page now to Six Questions. It is the last page in the magazine, written by Marcus J. Moore. John Legend is the subject, the 13-time Grammy winner, on revisiting his debut album 20 years later, his roots in the black church, and being sung to in airports. Now, it looks like there are more than six questions here to me, but maybe not all of them is a question. The title of the album says a lot, Get Lifted. What does that reference? Again, this is a question and answer format. Answer. I have a natural sense of optimism. It's just the way my brain works. So part of it was having that sense of spirituality and connection to gospel music. And I had already written the songs, Let's Get Lifted and So High, so it just felt like it was on theme. Get Lifted blends gospel, R&B, and hip-hop. How did you land on that sound? Answer, we knew that neo-soul had had its time. I wanted it to hit harder, sound bigger, have melodies that were less smooth and more sharp, more of an edge. A lot of neo-soul at the time sounded more like ad-libs and open mics, like a poetry session, and people were scatting their way through the song. I looked at the miseducation of Lauryn Hill as a big inspiration that mixed soul, hip-hop, reggae, and gospel. Question, the album hits me differently now as an adult in my 40s, going through a lot of transition and loss. Answer, or statement, I guess it is, it was just where we were as we were writing it, and some of it was not about my own experience. With ordinary people, it was my experience with my parents, who had gotten divorced when I was young. Then they got back together right after I graduated college, around 2000. They got remarried, then divorced again, as Get Lifted was about to come out. Question, it seems like the album was about the ups and downs of a personal relationship. What led to that? Answer, some of it was my parents, some was my own life. I was not in a serious relationship, but I had experience with infidelity and some of the things I wrote about. But whenever I write a song, it's always some mix of autobiography and allowing the creative process to take me where it takes me. I never feel bound by complete truth, but I want everything to feel true. Question, was there pushback against your using gospel to talk about infidelity? Answer, I think the black church is quite used to having R&B singers that blend gospel into secular music. I went to a Pentecostal church, and so many of our best R&B artists came from church. A lot of the leadership would be like, we don't want you out there making secular music, singing for the world. But by that point, I was far from home. I felt a sense of independence from my roots, where I could be myself. Question, how would you say you've evolved over the years? Answer, I just keep listening to my own muse and following what I was excited about. I made a children's album last year. I was like, I want to work with Sufjan Stevens. I didn't know if he was going to be like, why am I making a John Legend album? But he was down, and we made this special, beautiful thing. It was like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to make it interesting and artful and beautiful and whimsical. Another statement, when Ordinary People came out, it felt unconventional because it was just your voice and piano, whereas everything on the radio had big drums, big everything. Statement, everybody would tell me the song made them stop in their tracks because it was such a departure. I always thought that it was not my job to sound like everybody else, but to find a way to just be myself. And the final question, at what point did you know you had a thing with that record when it came out? Answer, I always say one thing is the airport test. When you're going through the airport, do people recognize you? And then, are they singing a song to you? And people were singing, we're just ordinary people, we're just ordinary people, everywhere I went. And then I always say, when I really knew I had made it was on the day I got a call in 05 from Magic Johnson and Oprah Winfrey. They both called me the same day, separately, for different reasons, but each of them wanted me to sing in an event they were throwing at their house. Here's a lovely black and white portrait photo of John Legend. He looks really young. I have no idea his age. He has, I would say, tan skin. But again, this is a black and white photo. Very closely and neatly shaved hair, again with neat facial hair. He's smiling slightly at the camera with dark eyes. Now, the suit he's wearing reminds me of one of those 1970s jacquard double knit deals. It has a long lapel and it's monochrome. I don't know what color it is. It's on the dark side with apparently a matching shirt and kind of loopy, ribbony tie, but he looks happy. Moving now to the brief, Protect and Defend by Philip Elliott and Nick Popley. Let's see if anybody else was involved in this. Yep, they're the authors. Okay. Long before FBI agents raided the Florida retreat to retrieve classified documents in August 2022, Mar-a-Lago had become a focus of spies from around the world. Early in his first term, Donald Trump and the Japanese Prime Minister plotted their response to a North Korean missile launch on the club's open-air patio, photos of which ended up on Facebook. 3 months later, the new president shared Israeli past intelligence with Russia's foreign minister, horrifying security leaders in Tel Aviv. A U.S. spy inside Vladimir Putin's regime was later extracted amid fears the disclosures could put the spook at risk. Trump also boasted to his Filipino counterpart that he had two nuclear submarines off the coast of North Korea. In 2019, he tweeted spy satellite images taken over Iranian airspace. The commander-in-chief's long record of recklessness with the nation's most valuable secrets is part of the backdrop for Signalgate, which saw senior U.S. security leadership discussing details of an impending and active military operation in a group chat that erroneously included the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. Not 60 days into his second term, Trump's carelessness has seeped into his administration, including people tasked with keeping the country safe. Trump officials confirmed the chat logs were authentic before dismissing their significance and attacking the story as a hoax. They have made a big deal out of this because we've had two perfect months, Trump complained, casting the posting of operational plans for an attack on a commercial messaging platform as first and foremost a public relations problem. Others understood the gravity of the situation. The senior officials were discussing secret planning for waves of military airstrikes March 15 on Yemen, where the Iranian-backed Houthi militia has fired on international shipping lanes for more than a year. Everyone on that text chain should have been fired, Senator Tammy Duckworth, an Illinois Democrat and Iraq War combat veteran, told Time. In disclosing the details, the most immediate danger, according to former military and security officials, was to the U.S. pilots, whose planned movements Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posted on the chat. But the implications reached beyond the mission at hand. In 2017, after U.S. officials shared details of a Manchester Arena bombing before the Brits were ready to release them, U.K. security services cut off the flow of secrets for a time. I am absolutely sure our allies are thinking twice about sharing classified information with us, Duckworth said. We've shown that our Secretary of Defense, Director of National Intelligence, NSA, National Security Advisor, are not capable of maintaining security over classified information. America First should not be America alone, Senator Mark Warner, a Virginia Democrat, said in an interview, and that's where we're headed. Republican lawmakers found themselves poll-axed. The party that controls both houses of Congress was caught between reflexive deference to Trump and foundational precepts on which the GOP has long stood. In the Senate, Republicans had largely ceded their constitutional oversight of presidential nominations in order to give Trump the team he wanted to carry out his agenda. Now, the CIA director, Director of National Intelligence, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and Vice President were on a hackable group chat organized by the National Security Advisor, who had somehow also invited a journalist. When the scandal broke, Majority Leader John Thune said his first instinct was to let the White House investigate. And after 2 days of deflection and obfuscation, insisting no classified information was shared on the chat, a probe was announced. The National Security Council, the White House Counsel's Office, and also, yes, Elon Musk's team would handle the investigation, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said March 26. By then, The Atlantic had rebutted the Trump team's spin by publishing screenshots it had initially held back, saying that as operational military attack plans, those passages were almost certainly classified. At the same time, Congress also began making noises about hearings, raising the possibility that the judiciary might not be the only branch of government to check or balance the executive. It is such a serious breach of national security, it's hard to imagine someone surviving, Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, told Time. But we're in the Trump era and anything goes. Indeed, the president's base retained its inertial power to hold Republicans in check. Barely 2 months into Trump's second term, disregarded security protocols had produced a high-stakes contest between governance and politics. The politics included Trump's threat to primary anyone deemed disloyal in the 2026 midterm elections. Everyone on the leaked signal chain had blasted former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2016 over the apparent national security catastrophe of her using a private email account. But Lock Her Up had found its update. Let it go. The View, the World, a liberal Trump card, question mark, by David Moscrop. Moscrop, M-O-S-C-R-O-P, is a columnist and author of Too Dumb for Democracy, question mark, Why We Make Bad Political Decisions and How We Can Make Better Ones. This article features a colored photograph. It's not a very large photograph, but it's mostly in red. The background is shaded in red, and the foreground is a sign on a podium, probably, that says liberal. It's in white against a red background with a maple leaf in white atop the E in liberal, behind which stands a man in a blue suit, white shirt, blue or black, I'm thinking dark blue tie. He has short-cropped gray hair. He's smiling. It is Mark Carney on March 9, after being elected party leader and Canada's prime minister-elect, reviving the liberal brand with help from south of the border. And Carney is spelled C-A-R-N-E-Y. What a difference mere weeks have made in Canada. As the new year came and went, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his ruling Liberals, after a decade in power, were trailing the Conservatives by 25 points and facing electoral oblivion. An election was due by fall. It was looking as if it might come earlier. The opposition parties in the House were working to bring down the government. Today, Canada's in the midst of that early election, but the circumstances are night and day. Trudeau's gone, replaced by former Bank of Canada and Bank of England Governor Mark Carney. And it was Carney himself who called a snap election for April 28. Most surprising of all, the Liberals are back up in the polls and now favored to win. And it's all thanks to a brash American in the Oval Office. The past 3 months have embodied the old maxim that events, dear boy, events can upset the odds in short order. After Donald Trump was elected in November, Canadians became nervous about what his second term might mean for the country. That it would not be anything good was obvious come December, when Trump bullied Trudeau, vowed sweeping tariffs, threatened annexation to make Canada the cherished 51st state. With Trump's taunts, the pressure on the highly unpopular Trudeau to step aside only grew. Canada needed a new, full-time, focused leader with plenty of runway to deal with Trump and his bid for hemispheric dominance. So Trudeau announced his resignation January 6, the date Trump's win was certified. A short Liberal leadership race followed in March, and Carney became prime minister. March 23, he called a snap election as voters are rallying around the flag and the incumbent Liberals and against the Yankee menace down south. The Liberal leadership race was centered on who could best deal with Trump and Canada's erstwhile ally. The April 28 vote will share that focus. The federal government had already shot back at the U.S. with reciprocal 25% tariffs before Trudeau left office. Carney's promising to continue the fight. It was hard to miss that his first foreign trip as prime minister was to France and the U.K., and Carney has said Canada will not enter U.S. trade talks until Trump drops the 51st state talk and shows some respect. That harder talk seems to be paying off in a land where voters are booing the U.S. anthem at sporting games, canceling vacations across the border, and boycotting American goods. Canadians are furious at Trump and the U.S., and Carney is deftly seizing that anger and leaving his main opponent, Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre, in an awkward spot. Poilievre has also promised to stand up to Trump, arguing he's a tough guy who can handle the U.S. president, but he is seen by many as a Trump-inspired figure. And the Liberals are working overtime to paint him as Maple MAGA. His base is typically Trump-friendly, even if most Canadians are not. Those same Canadians also see Carney's Liberals as better suited to handle Trump, according to a poll published in March by Ipsos, with 43% of them worried Poilievre would roll over to the president's demands. Unfortunately for Poilievre, Trump is the defining election issue given how crucial the bilateral relationship is to Canada's prosperity and security. Canada and the U.S. have a close defense relationship with joint membership in NATO and NORAD, the Continental Aerospace Command. The countries share national security information, though Trump has mused about kicking Canada out of the Five Eyes intelligence network. Trade between the U.S. and Canada is worth over $1 trillion Canadian dollars a year. According to Global Affairs Canada, that trade employs about 8 million Americans, and Canada is the leading export partner for 32 states, sending essential goods like potash, which is crucial for agriculture, as well as uranium, aluminum, and critical minerals. The U.S. auto sector is also intimately connected with Canada's and accounts for 3% of U.S. GDP. Despite this interdependence, the economic relationship is lopsided, and Canadians know they are vulnerable. With Canada's economy, defense, and even sovereignty on the line, it is no surprise the ongoing election is about Trump and who can best handle him and how. yet it is still a shock to witness the ultra-rapid revival of a liberal party that was written off as moribund not so long ago. If the liberals do indeed survive and hold on to power come April 28, they will have Trump to thank, but they'll also have him to deal with. The Risk Report by Ion Bremmer, Turkey's Declining Democracy. Once again, Turkey faces political turmoil. Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, that's I-M-A-M-O-G-L-U, of Turkey's main opposition, Republican People's Party, CHP, was detained March 19, then formally arrested March 23. He stands accused of a host of poorly evidenced charges, establishing and managing a criminal organization, taking bribes, extortion, unlawfully recording personal data, and rigging a tender. İmamoğlu, who called the charges a black stain on our democracy, has also been suspended from his position as mayor. If convicted, as is expected, he will not be allowed to run for president. Despite this, the CHP, which says the arrest is politically motivated, held its previously scheduled primary and named İmamoğlu as its presidential candidate for the 2028 election. Meanwhile, protests continue to rock Turkey. Police have moved quickly to contain them in Istanbul, the largest city, Ankara, the capital, Izmir, and other cities around the country. We have seen this scenario before. Erdogan has now been in power for 22 years, and he intends to remain there. He's tightened his government's control of the military, which launched a failed coup against him in 2016, the country's justice system and its media. Against that backdrop, the arrest of the candidate most likely to defeat Erdogan is unsurprising. When İmamoğlu was first elected Istanbul's mayor in 2019, Erdogan claimed the election had been stolen and ordered a do-over, but İmamoğlu won the rerun by a wider margin, and CHP has since won control of every major city in Turkey. Erdogan is calculating he can ride out the protests. He's done it before. When his government announced in the summer of 2013 that Istanbul's Gezi or Gezi Park, G-E-Z-I, one of the city's few green spaces, was to be redeveloped to include a rebuilt Ottoman military barracks and a shopping mall, demonstrators began occupying the park. When police launched a harsh crackdown on those who had set up tents, public anger at Erdogan's response triggered startlingly intense nationwide protests. Erdogan was able to let them pass, and nearly a dozen years later, he has a much firmer grip on the country. Still, CHP leader Özgür Özel and other opposition politicians will try to keep İmamoğlu's story in the public eye by mobilizing the CHP's 1.7 million members. March 24, Özel called for a boycott of any media outlet that refuses to cover the protests. It will once again accuse Erdogan of using the power of the state against Turkey's democracy. But the Turkish president's ability to quell those protests make any threat to his government unlikely to succeed. By March 26, more than 1,400 protesters had been arrested since İmamoğlu's detention. Erdogan himself has accused demonstrators and protest organizers of stirring unrest to disturb the peace and polarize our people. The government has so far largely tolerated mass protests in Istanbul, where hundreds of thousands have been gathering. But elsewhere around the country, further from the public eye, they look set to be suppressed by any means necessary. There are also moves to push opposition voices off social media. Erdogan is not facing much international pressure to change course. The European Commission issued a statement calling on Erdogan's government to uphold democratic values, but it does not have leverage here. Turkey's president has a strong relationship with Donald Trump. All who want less volatility in the Middle East also want Erdogan to help stabilize the new government in Syria. And Europe wants NATO member Turkey to back its security guarantees for a ceasefire in Ukraine. İmamoğlu's arrest marks one more big step toward authoritarianism in Turkey, where democracy already came with an asterisk. There's one small photo inset here. It's mostly in purple and red and black, but the main character is dressed all in black. He's actually the only one we see in totality. The rest are in a blurry background. He's wearing a face mask depicting a skull, a skeletal skull. The caption reads, "Protesters rally in Istanbul March 24 to support the city's mayor, whose arrest threw the nation into tumult." Health Matters by Alice Park, senior health correspondent. March 25, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first new antibiotic in 30 years to treat urinary tract infections, UTIs. The medication, Geptotidacin, Geptotidacin, Geptotidacin, is marketed as Blujepa, Blujepa. It targets the E. coli bacteria responsible for the most common types of infections, but works differently than existing antibiotics. The drug targets two enzymes that E. coli uses to make more copies of itself when it generates and snips off circles of its DNA. During that process, the DNA can become knotted, and the bacteria can undo those knots. Blujepa interferes with that process, which prevents the bacteria from replicating and producing more bacteria that can infect cells. Tony Wood, chief scientific officer at GSK, which makes Blujepa, told reporters that this process is unique to E. coli bacteria and that a drug targeting the process could make it harder for the bacteria to develop resistance to the drug, which can be an issue with existing antibiotics. In two large trials of the drug that the FDA reviewed for approval, Blujepa was as good as, or slightly better than, another commonly prescribed antibiotic for UTIs, nitrofurantoin. That's nitrofurantoin. In the two studies, Blujepa successfully treated 50% and 58%, respectively, of women with infections, compared with nitrofurantoin's success rates of 43% and 47%. Climate is Everything by Simone Shaw, climate reporter. The Trump administration's fixation on Greenland comes as the Danish autonomous territory faces a future complicated by climate change. Rising temperatures are accelerating the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, the largest ice mat in the northern hemisphere. The thaw, coupled with warming oceans, has altered the area's ecosystems and food security. At first sight, it seems these changes could open up new economic and strategic opportunities, ones the U.S. and others may want to tap. But the reality is more complicated than that. There is a perceived military benefit, and there is a perceived economic benefit, says Paul Bierman, B-I-E-R-M-A-N, professor of natural resources at the University of Vermont. Melting sea ice, for example, could open up a new trade route and allow strategic access to the Arctic. But Bierman adds, I actually think both of these ideas are false. Greenland is home to a wealth of oil, gas, and minerals, and the receding ice has spurred hopes of a mineral gold rush. But accessing these resources is not as easy as it sounds. The nation has a limited road network, and a large portion of the region is built on permafrost, which presents building challenges. It is a tricky ground to create infrastructure on, says Asa Rennermalm, professor in the Department of Geography at Rutgers. Many areas of Greenland are also closed to extraction after the territory's parliament voted to stop oil and gas exploration and uranium mining in 2021. On top of this, the melting ice sheets are not going to help resource extraction. There is this fantasy that the ice sheets are going to melt away overnight, and all these new exotic minerals are going to appear where there used to be 1,000 feet of ice, says Bierman. That is not going to happen. Ice melt caused by climate change can trigger landslides, which can damage mining infrastructure in mere seconds. Greenland's changing climate also holds potential for the U.S.'s artificial intelligence ambitions. During a February 12 Senate hearing on the acquisition of Greenland, Rebecca Pincus, director of the Polar Institute at the Wilson Center, spoke of the potential for the melting ice sheet to provide the energy for hydropower-fueled AI data centers. The Trump administration's near-term political ambitions, however, ignore the larger issue, say experts. The Arctic is warming 3 to 4 times as fast as the rest of the world. If Greenland's ice sheet were to melt completely, it would raise global sea levels by 23 feet. Even just a fraction of that is going to have huge impact, says Rennermalm. It will radically change the rest of the world. Coastal areas from Mumbai to Mar-a-Lago could be underwater. If we do not take care of that ice sheet, there are estimates in the many trillion dollars of economic losses, says Bierman. That does not fit in the 4-year political cycle. The DC Brief by Charlotte Alter. This is a question and answer format. Charlotte Alter is senior correspondent. I don't know how many of these will finish, but I'm going to forge ahead. It may be abbreviated. Representative Jake Auchincloss's Massachusetts district is so safe, he did not even face a Republican opponent in 2024. So while some Democrats are focused on the careful messaging needed to appease swing voters, Auchincloss, 37, is fixated on the broader question facing his party. What went wrong for Democrats? Answer, it is encapsulated in the school closures. Those are elementary school kids who did not learn reading and writing because it was on Zoom. That's high school kids who missed out on baseball practice. And what defined those school closures was a condescension. It was an inflexibility. It was a resistance to feedback about the effects of our government's decisions. It is not enough to say we were wrong on this. We also have to have a plan for how we are gonna remediate it. What should that plan be? One, we should make a commitment of one-on-one high-dosage tutoring for every kid who's behind grade level. We know it is one of the few educational interventions that are rigorously tested for efficacy. The second thing we should do is hold the social media corporations to account for their generational attention fracking of our youth. I have legislation that's bipartisan to revoke Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and make social media corporations accountable to a duty of care, and a 50% tax rate on all digital advertising. Use it to fund initiatives like local journalism and education. Question, does the party need a new direction? Answer, that is the core challenge we have. We are bereft of big ideas. Question, what should be the Democrats' next big idea? Answer, let me put a few more out there. We have got to stop focusing on expanding health care coverage and focus instead on lowering health care costs. Community health clinics account for about 1% of U.S. health care spending, but they treat 10% of Americans. They are primary and preventative care. And if they could team up with hospitals in particular, they can be incredibly effective stewards of health care dollars. We have to start subsidizing them directly, as opposed to what we currently do, which is subsidize the health insurance companies. What should be the Democrats' core economic agenda? Answer, the average family spends relatively less on TVs and electronics and relatively more on health care than they did 50 years ago. The reason is that in sectors where they're able to do at-scale product manufacturing, the cost goes way down. In sectors that are very labor-intensive, costs tend to go up over time. TVs got really cheap to make. Health care is very labor-intensive. Child care is very labor-intensive. The goal, then? How do you turn a service into a product? And then how do you mass-produce that product? And the last question, what does that mean for housing? Answer, we totally have to do land use reform. We got to make it easier to build. But we also have to figure out how to turn housing construction from a very service-intensive endeavor into a product. And we actually know how to do that, off-site construction. One way to break through is to get serious about building new cities in this country. Americans used to build new cities every time we ran into a river. We have got lots of decommissioned military bases that are not locally zoned, federal land that is not locally zoned. And with a couple minutes left, Earth Awards 2025, Individuals Influencing the Future of the Planet Through Work on Climate Justice, Leadership, Awareness, and Activism. This is Time's list. I don't know how many appear on the list, but I'll read a few names to you. Jay Inslee, former governor of Washington. Michael Bloomberg tends to avoid the press. The New York City mayor turned climate advocate is not a regular guest on cable news, but having helped close more than 300 coal-fired power plants in the U.S., cut New York City's emissions by nearly 20%, and contributed more than $1 billion to climate action, he has a story to tell. In 1981, Bloomberg launched what would become a media empire by providing data that informs financial decision-making. During his three terms as New York City mayor, from 2002 to 2013, he applied that same data-driven approach to advance pragmatic solutions on a wide range of issues, from crime to public health, even if at times that approach put him out of step with politics. Selassie Atadika is an innovative Ghanaian chef who lays out a recipe for a sustainable food future. Bill First, F-I-R-S-T, working across the aisle requires talking about the human impacts of climate change. Rain, R-A-I-N-N, maybe I'm misspelling that, Wilson, the stories we tell as artists cannot ignore the science, writes the co-founder of Climate Basecamp. Samuel Beckett would have been as delighted as a toddler with a bubble blower at the dark absurdity of my situation. November 6, 2024, hundreds of people braved Los Angeles traffic and sat for the first preview performance of Beckett's Waiting for Godot at the Giffen Playhouse. All of those Earth Awards articles were abridged considerably. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.